Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, December 7th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. If you keep reading on that page and scroll down, there are a whole host of other tools available in this work to support you in discovering what you might have in your mind and your body's energy system that's less than love, that can be seen and dismantled effectively and efficiently with the use of these tools, and give you the option to have a better, happier, more productive, creative, loving life. We hope people do that soon and often because it frequently leads to comments and questions or testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, please give us a call at 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1. It'll put a little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. We are on day 341. Today, the message preceding today's lesson is the question, what is a miracle? And the answer that's offered in 5 paragraphs of commentary begins with and is simply this: a miracle is a correction. A miracle does not create nor really change anything at all. It merely looks on devastation and reminds the mind that what it sees is false. A miracle undoes error, right? And it paves the way for the return of timelessness and love's awakening. So, everything we see that's less than love is a mistake, is an error in perception. And the miracle is simply a turning away from fear towards love. a shift in perception from fear towards love. Lesson 341 for today says, I can attack but my own sinlessness, and it is only that which keeps me safe. Now, that is one of the phrases in A Course in Miracles that has people scratching their heads and saying, what does that really mean? And another way to make that statement is, the only thing that I can attack is with my thoughts, I can choose to believe that I have sin. And I can't have sin. There is no such thing as original sin in the ancient Aramaic. It's something more like original blessing. It's a gift of life that you've been given. It's the awareness of life that you have that allows you to be aware of anything whatsoever. And there is nothing in you that is bad or damaged or wrong or needs repair in any way. And the essence of that truth contains your perfect safety. The commentary here reads, Creator, your offspring is holy. We are the ones who, upon whom you smile. In love and tenderness, so dear and so deep and so still that the universe itself smiles back on you. And the universe itself shares your holiness. So let us not then attack our sinlessness. Let us not create beliefs that we have imperfections and sin and we need correction, etc. For our sinlessness is contained in the word of the Creator, in the creation itself. And in its kind reflection, we are saved. In the reflection of the truth of life, we see there's nothing to be undone except our errors in thought. It's the core of the Course in Miracles teaching. And lesson 341 from Pam Grout's Course in Miracles experiment is titled, Anything You Can Do, ... She quotes William James, who said, to change your life, start immediately. Do it flamboyantly and make no exceptions. Pam writes, the soundtrack of my childhood, thanks to my mom, who was a pianist and a church organist, the soundtrack was hymns and Broadway tunes. I was particularly fond of Annie Get Your Gun, where Annie Oakley and Frank Butler, playing one-upmanship, sang to each other, anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you. And I think of that song whenever I think about JC or Yeshua or Jesus Christ or whatever you want to call him. You know, the cute guy with the beard and the sandals that according to the Bible told us point blank, quote, any miracle he can do, we can do better. We can do any miracle better than him, closing quotes. Pam writes, so far, I have yet to walk on the Sea of Galilee or turn water into my favorite glass of Cabernet, but neither activity resides on the top 10 of my bucket list. I'm more motivated by miracles of love, where people who used to hate each other realize they don't, or where some limiting belief that kept me stuck in an old pattern gets turned into a whole new possibility. Lesson 341 says, it's time to start performing miracles, to start one-upping JC, because he would have it no other way. So there we have lesson 341. I am sinless, and it is that which keeps me completely safe. And any attack I create is a falsehood of thought, and it's correctable. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1, and we can have a conversation. How can we support you today? We've got about 50 minutes left for conversation, testimonial, worksheet process. Today is a Tuesday, which means We will have a support group tonight that will be available through Zoom from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. It is available, all the information about how to join us is available at mindshiftersacademy.org website. And please remember there is a separate login page for Tuesday and Thursday because the access numbers are different. And we fairly routinely now have somebody try to join us using the wrong day's access numbers. So, how can we support you today? What's on your mind? What words would you like to speak or hear spoken that might help point you in the direction of an experience that is life-altering? Because, again, that is basically our intention, our whole purpose for being here is not the words we're speaking. It's the possibility that each of us can engage in to have a different experience of our life. We can use these tools. We can access the power behind the principles, and we can have a better experience of life moment to moment when we step into the use of these tools. So if you're not familiar with the tools, as I was saying in the intro, please go to whyagain.org, whyagain.org, and click on the red and white bullseye. That's farther down the page these days, so I don't usually talk about that on the new website, but it's still there, or the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner of most pages. And then have at it. There is, I forget how many thousands of pages of information there. This work has been going for a lot of years. Sometimes I hear Michael say almost 50, sometimes 40 some. And the core of the work is wrapped around the Course in Miracles and around the Kabbalist manuscript, which is the oldest known copy of the New Testament, which for a while was being translated directly from the ancient Aramaic into English. And some of the, we call it wisdom, we call it insights that were gained from that work have been made available in what Michael calls the Enlightenment book that he will offer for sale on that website. It's also woven into the tools that are made available for free. And the point is, how can we remove everything that's false, less than love, from our mind-body-energy system? What does it take for us to step into, Michael would call it our birthright, the direct awareness of our true nature as love, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year round. And I frequently discuss with people a two-prong approach, which is, number one, remind yourself or get the reminders or learn about how you are a miracle of life. You are a miracle of the creative energy expressing in form. And that's the first prong. Find ways to remind yourself of your true loving nature, because it's the same as the true loving nature of everyone you see, even those who may not be acting lovingly. And then the next thing is, the second prong of the approach is to make the commitment to own, to step into the realization that every time you're not able to actively access awareness of that first truth, there's an error in your thought process. And if you own that, if you step into the use of tools to remove the errors in thought and or tap into the guidance that's available to each and every one of us through this energy system we call a mind-body and ask to be shown the errors of your thought. And if you have tools to use, like the ones that are made available absolutely free on whyagain.org, then you apply the tools, and then you restore your awareness to your true nature as love, and life keeps getting better, day after day, moment after moment. And that's a two-prong approach we're recommending, and we're here to support you in doing. I was having a conversation with somebody this morning who's struggling, trying to get other people that he knows to learn the same things he's learning in this work. And one of the pitfalls is that people have different language, or they use language to carry the meaning of words that are very different from what the meaning is for the people they're communicating with. And then, time to time, people will decide to have an argument over what the real meaning of this word is. And when that happens, I just encourage people to recognize what Krishnamurti would say so often: the word is not the thing. Your thoughts about yourself are not the same as yourself. Your words describing yourself are not who you are. Your ego is not who you are. And the ego is not some evil thing. It is not something to be beaten. It is not something to be mastered. It is not something to be fought against. Because it's simply a collection of thoughts. And as most of us have had the direct experience, our thoughts change moment to moment. Our thoughts are as fluid as the wind. And so it doesn't make sense to fight against the wind. It doesn't make sense to fight against your thoughts, because that's all your ego is your thoughts about yourself. So when somebody wants to argue with you about the nature of truth or the nature of God or who's right or who's wrong about any given issue, I would call your attention to the process they use in the book, The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership. And they say in that book, and I'll remind you that in that book what they're doing is they're counseling, they're coaching corporate leaders and executives, presidents, CEOs, etc., owners of businesses. And what they say in that book when they're trying to introduce this topic to people is, think about something that you absolutely know is true. And most often, people in their groups will pick something like 2 plus 2 is 4, some simple math theorem that they've got proof for. It's worked well in their life, and they just don't have any doubt about the actuality of that statement. And then they ask the person, now, if someone came up to you and wanted to argue with you that 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4, how much energy would you spend trying to convince them that you're right and they're wrong? And all these executives, you know, say, well, basically none. I mean, I don't have to prove anything. I know it's right, and I don't feel any need to argue with somebody who won't accept the basic truth of that statement. And they say, okay, so now the next question is, what is something in your life right now today for which you think you know the truth and somebody else disagrees with you? And of course, most of the time, that fairly readily comes to people's minds. And then they ask the people in their seminar to think, how much energy have you spent or are you willing to spend to try to convince other people that you're right and they're wrong about this other issue. Whether it's, you know, how much money the sales department needs to spend in order to keep up with, you know, the corporate goals, or whether or not the HR has a bad policy and needs to be corrected, or whether or not an employee down in the warehouse needs to be fired for whatever misdeeds. And they talk about it, and they've got a lot of energy for trying to convince other people that they're right about one of those personal issues or individual issues. And so then the corporate leaders ask, or the trainers ask the corporate leaders to think, what's the difference between these two things? One of which you won't spend much of any energy on trying to convince the other person, and the other which you're willing to fight tooth and nail to convince the person. And as they discuss it and work through it, what they find time and time again is the simple math theorem is something that they absolutely know is true. There's no doubt in their mind whatsoever. And the other issues about which they're willing to fight tooth and nail to try and convince someone that they are right and the other person is wrong, these things have some question. The individual who wants to fight to prove them right can't absolutely know that it's true. So the invitation here is to wake up and understand that whenever I argue with anybody about anything, I'm in error. Because in my words, the argument means that I've got an emotional intensity for this, and that emotional intensity is an indication that I'm not seeing things clearly, because when I see it clearly and what I want to argue for is absolutely true and I know it to be true, I don't argue over it. I don't put any emotional intensity into trying to prove it to one person or another. So we have a lot of people these days who are listening to opposing news feeds, and they'll want to argue. You know, there is a conspiracy in the United States. There is a conspiracy in the government. There's a conspiracy with the drug companies. There's, you know, people are being forced to take medical treatments that they don't want to take, and that's bad and wrong, and people should be able to have the right to have an abortion, and people should not be able to kill an unborn child, and back and forth and up and down. And so the invitation with this work is to recognize that how the relative or absolute truth of an issue may or may not exist out in actuality, none of that is related to the negative emotional states that I generate or the positive emotional states that I generate when my mind is focused on one or more of those issues. And so the invitation in this work is to monitor much more closely, much more carefully, what I'm doing with my thought process, because that's the only thing that's ever created an emotional state within me. And if I don't like the emotional state I'm creating, and I have awakened to the fact that I'm the one that creates that emotional state, then I can choose again. I can choose differently. And that's what the invitation is with this work. That's what Course in Miracles calls us to time and time again. That's what Way of Masteries calls us to time and time again. Whenever my emotional state is in any kind of negativity, I could choose to use that in the best possible way as a piece of information that says, hey, Tim, your thoughts are in error. Your thoughts are off the mark. And if I'm willing to do that, I get the benefits, especially if I've been introduced to tools like the ones available at whyagain.org. So, as so many people call us to, so many great spiritual traditions call us to understand, the truth is that you're a miracle of life expressing in form. And the truth doesn't need you to get angry in order to promote it or defend it. So we have tools that can support you if you are dealing with something like the loss of a loved one or stress around the holidays. Or I've had several people this week already. Here we are only Tuesday morning. And between yesterday and this morning's sessions, I've had several people who are looking at gathering with family or friends for the holidays and anticipating drama and trauma. And saying things like, well, it's family, so I'm willing to take the hit. Or, I really don't want to go, but I know I should. Or, this is going to be brutal. I hate December. I've always hated December. It's been full of trauma and losses in my family and on and on and on. So if you're one of those people who has a negative history with the holidays or traumas in the month of November, December, January, and you're dreading this, the tools at whyagain.org are available absolutely free, and they are powerful remedies to the processes that you're engaging in, wittingly or unwittingly, to create your own negative emotions. And we invite you to go there. Download the tools and put them to use in your life. And then call us and talk about how it works to put those tools to use and or what you'd like to be able to learn about the tools to be more effective with them. That's why we're here. And we've got about 30 minutes left, so give us a call, 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1, and we can have a conversation. Welcome, Susan.
So this is synchronicity again, Dr. Tim. You have got your finger on the very thing that I've been just totally fussing about lately. Like, the things that I absolutely know cause me no problem because I know them. One and one is two, sort of thing. But what you're saying is in the reverse. If we have a strong feeling or opinion about something and we want to argue with someone else, you're saying we aren't sure. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any upset connected with it. Right? Is that what you're saying?
That is the message in the 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership. That's one of the most powerful tools they have in their list of things to help people understand that when they're getting emotionally attached to one side of an issue and feeling like they're ready to fight to the death or, you know, go to the next level or escalate to verbal intensity or physical intensity, that's what they've learned. That only happens when there's a level of question in the mind of the person. When there's no question, okay, you don't want to believe 2 + 2 = 4? Okay, I don't think I'd want to manage your finances, but that's okay.
Yeah. So that reminds me of Byron Katie, because she says, is it true? Do you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's true?
Exactly. Same wisdom and coming right through.
Yeah. Same with what, Dr. Kim?
That's the same wisdom coming right through.
Yeah. Okay.
She says, I only suffer when I believe my thoughts.
Right. And then you're talking about the ego. Before you talked about this specifically, you were talking about the ego, and this is all the work of the ego. And my mind's going all over the place, gathering pieces of what you said yesterday and already today. The Pema Chodron thing about how the ego is afraid of death. And that was one of her, did she call it reproaches? Is that the word?
I think one of the last strengths is reproachment.
Reproachment.
The five strengths.
Yeah, it isn't reproachment. I think I'm asking. There's a French word, rapprochement, which doesn't mean reproachment. It's almost like a revealing or the tying up of loose ends or something like that. And when you said reproaches, it's funny because during the season of Advent, no, the season of Lent, there are a series of musical chants, maybe they're just words, but in our parish we always sing them, called the reproaches. I'm way off now. Let's go away from that. But
in the five strengths, and this is through Pema Chodron, and you can find it if you just search for Pema Chodron, the five strengths, Buddhist five strengths.
Okay.
Strong determination is one, familiarization is the other, seed of virtue is the third, and reproach is the fourth, and aspiration is the fifth. Right? And the fourth strength is called reproach. This one requires talking to yourself, right? Talking to this pattern of thoughts that people label the ego. But the whole point of this is to understand the ego is not a real thing. The ego is not a thing like your coffee cup that you can hold in your hand and fill with coffee or water or juice. It is not a thing. It's just a collection of thoughts, and it changes moment to moment. And the fourth strength, called reproach, requires one to talk to oneself and say, ego, you've done nothing but cause me problems for ages, which is, in other words, just to say, to see how an errant pattern of thought is always what's responsible for my negative emotions.
Good.
So I'm not going to buy into the thought pattern that psychologists or spiritual teachers might call ego. I'm not going to buy into it. I'm going to do Byron Katie's work, and I'm going to question it. And when I question my thoughts and I understand their true nature, they cease the pattern of causing suffering within me.
The ego is such a pain in the ass. I mean, I decided to...
You mean your thoughts are a pain in the ass?
My ego is, the whole thing.
Just look at what I'm trying to help you do here. Quit calling it a real thing.
Good. Okay.
If you come to see me in my office, and all of a sudden in the middle of a session, I say to you, I'd love to finish our session, but I need to deal with this pink tiger in the corner. And I don't think I can do it alone. Can you help me? And we start having a discussion about how to get rid of the pink tiger in the corner, and your whole session, the second half of your session, is used up with that. What's happening there? There's no pink tiger. But the more we talk about it, or we talk about my thoughts about it, the more we're distracted from the actuality of life. So when you say my ego, it's not yours. It isn't a real thing. It doesn't belong to you or anyone else. It's a movement of thought.
Well, okay, whatever it is called, I'm having a problem with it.
Right, so I'm trying to help you soften it, because when you use your words and label something, you give them a real palpable energy. And you're
That's
one who
true.
Wants to know, and you're going to, you know, figure it out with your thoughts. And I'm trying to help you understand this thing you're doing with your mind is making it more solid and real. And you don't have to keep doing that. You can recognize that what you're doing with your thoughts is making your ego this real thing. And it's no more than the movement of thought. and it doesn't have any more validity, any more validity than any other thought. And it doesn't have any more direct impact on your life than a 2-mile-an-hour breeze when you're out on a beautiful sunny day.
Okay,
unless you start to believe in it, unless you start to conceptualize it, talk about it, and relate to it as a thing. My ego, this, my ego, that. I don't have an ego as a thing, like I've got a left hand and a right hand, and you know, two knees and two hips. Those are things. I can talk about those. But my ego, when I start vocalizing it that way, when I start labeling it that way, I start to think of it as a real thing. I'm trying to help you soften that and move out of treating it as anything other than a movement of thought. And when you step into, you know, you mentioned Byron Katie, when you question your thought, you see they're all false. And they lose their power over you. And that's essentially what this fourth strength is called, reproach. It has me talking to the ego and saying, listen, I'm not going to buy it anymore. I'm not going to believe what you tell me anymore. I'm not going to beat myself up for having those thoughts. I'm simply going to see their true nature as false and let them go and move on to something that can be seen, observed, felt, that's more loving, that's more real, that's more has creative energy in it.
Tim Bingham has something on very loud. I'm going to shut a door. Okay. Well, I feel as if my life has a wide, wide road. I'm walking down a wide, wide road. And if I were to divide the road into my free, loving, egoless self and the ego self.
Thought pattern.
I would have a little teeny sidewalk on one side. That's the loving self. And the whole rest of the road is more like an avenue or a boulevard. It's wide. And there's so much stuff there that I feel today as if the more worksheets I do, the more willingness I'm expressing, the more garbage is showing up. Probably just to be dealt with. But there are certain issues that remain triggers, and I haven't gotten rid of them, even with all the work I've done. Maybe I shouldn't even be talking on the radio show. Maybe this is just too negative.
No, I think it's fine. I think it's fine, although if you were, you know, with Pema Chodron right now, and she was talking about those strengths, she would say, now right now you're getting negative. And so catch the negativity and release it. You know, this reproach, she says, reproach can be very powerful. You teach yourself the Dharma, which means the flow of life, what actually is. You teach it to yourself in your own words. And you can teach yourself anything that has to do with the moment. And you can catch the moment when you're just about to create a pain or a suffering for yourself or some scar. And you can teach it to yourself just like any master teacher would teach it to you.
You know what,
Dr.
Tim, you're right.
Go ahead.
And I do that. I do that a lot. And I read a cool thing, and it may or may not be true. And the thing is, we can change neuropathways if we repeat the changed positive, if we repeat the new good wanted thought many, many times, and they gave a number like 400 or 40, I don't know. But if you reprogram yourself while you are having fun, you are playing, it takes far fewer repetitions before that new neural pathway has kicked in. I hope that made sense.
Yep. Yeah, play with it. Have fun. Don't beat yourself up over it.
But
understand that it's the movement of thought. Just the movement
Did
of thought.
Did you say beat myself up over it?
Yeah, don't beat yourself up over it.
Oh, I thought you said go ahead and beat yourself up over it. That's the truth. That's what...
We tend to beat ourselves up over this stuff, but it isn't necessary, and it isn't productive. All it does is reinforce the trauma patterns in the brain or the neural pathways that lead to the upset that we say we want to get rid of.
Okay, well, I'm hoping there's another caller so I can get off the hot seat.
Well, you're welcome to get off the hot seat, even though there's not another caller right now. And, I would just call you to just watch what you do with your words and the energy behind your words when you start talking about, quote, your ego, close quotes. There is no such thing as the ego. It's just a word. It's like what I said to you the other day. I think I said it to you. I can tell you what God is. It's a three-letter word.
Right. I love the word.
That's all it is.
Yeah, a placeholder.
It's just a symbol of a symbol.
Okay, so I'm getting back on the hot seat. I have another thing to ask. I've been working with Mira Rubin, and she suggested keeping a journal. And what she suggested was to keep a journal of the ahas, the wonderful realizations. So what do I do? I get a journal that I used to keep a lot. And I decide, well, maybe I need to dump the garbage first. So I write three paragraphs of things that I'm upset about, mad about, so forth. And I thought, well, I don't know whether I'm just fanning these flames. So I decide maybe that's not a bad idea, not a good idea. That was a good slip, not a bad idea. I still don't know. Then I go for a walk today, and I'm picturing, okay, here I am wanting to have a conversation in my head with someone I haven't seen in a year and a half. And our friendship, you know what it is, it didn't end well. And I want to still convince her that I had my good reasons for leaving and evade her possible, imagined, or maybe true anger at me and feeling done wrong by me. So I decide I'm going to trundle along a big barrel beside me when I walk. And I'm dumping all of the negative stuff into the barrel in hopes to clear it out so that I can have a walk and notice the trees and notice the day and love it and be happy. And I'm thinking, no, that's just like keeping the journal. I'm stashing stuff into huge piles of garbage. For what purpose? I think the purpose is to prove I'm right. That's not a good purpose.
You're right about what?
Whatever I'm
right about
obsessing
what?
About. You name it. Whatever the issue is, my side
okay,
is
well,
right.
Okay, how about it shows up, like this thought shows up about this relationship then, and the person you haven't talked to in a year and a half. How about it shows up just so you can say, oh, I've got more worksheets to do on this.
Okay.
Oh, I'm still holding resentment or confusion or hurt that I'm not clear of. Oh, I'm still blaming her or blaming myself. Or just how about I just use it as awakening and awareness?
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, then I get the feeling I'm sick and tired of this and I don't want to do the worksheets. I know how they're going to come out. This is extreme negativity.
And then maybe I do a worksheet on how I'm sick and tired of this.
That's good. You keep going down below the junk. That's good.
Just go to whatever thought process I'm using to generate a negativity in my mind, body, spirit – It's all self-induced nonsense, the acronym for sin that is so useful. Right? Mm. It's all self-induced nonsense. So I can choose to wallow in it, or I can choose to step through it. But it's okay. It's your life. If you want to wallow in it, it's okay. Wallow for as long as you want.
Okay. That's the cat. Sorry about that. Cat is commentary.
You can deny the use of the tools. You can deny the existence of the tools. It's okay. You can say this is all baloney. This doesn't work. That's okay, too. And then, you know, what this work would call you to do is then just observe.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel? Does it feel good? Is it something you want to keep doing? If not, then this work, A Course in Miracles, Way of Mastery, would call you to choose again. Diedrich Wolzak's work would say, okay, you don't like what you're getting with these results here, then choose again. Choose a different pattern of thought. Choose to use the tools or not. And then stay awake to what you're creating as your experience when you do that. That's what?
I've had a lot of moments when I've turned away a negative thought and turned my thoughts to something else without doing a worksheet, just saying, oh, there you are again. Okay, I'm not going over there. I have been doing that, and it just came to me that I have this belief, and it's probably just the thought, like the others, that the demons, and I'm saying demons even though they're not external to me, are... It's like a candle. They say a candle burns brightest before it goes out or something. I feel as if we're down, they're cornered now. They're cornered, these guys, and they're going to put up a big fight. So that's just an idea. But I like to think that maybe they're just putting up a big fight because they're really, really losing the battle.
Okay. And another way to think about it is, it's not they are fighting. It's there's some part of me. Right? There aren't any external demons. There's only me and my fears.
Mm-hmm.
And so some part of me that's fearful has gotten resonated at a deeper level.
Okay.
So just understand that when I feel that the candle's burning brighter or the demons are fighting harder, it's just me, it's just my mind, it's my fears. And when I'm not afraid of something, I walk right into it. And if I'm resisting walking into something, that means I'm generating fear somehow. That's just how life works. So, all right, what am I afraid of? Am I willing to take a look at it? Yes, then I use the tools and look at it. If I'm not willing to take a look at it, I say, okay. And then I will slumber in my suffering because I will continue to suffer, and all my suffering is self-induced nonsense. So here is Ellen with a hand up, and you mentioned earlier that we should turn
definitely.
Other people on when they
Ellen's
come in. So here's
you.
Ellen.
Hello. Hi, Susan. Hi, Dr. Tim. Hi.
Hello.
I just wanted to add my 2 cents worth, because this is what, you know, I was reminded of again this morning, and, like, I often forget about this, and then it's, like, such a nice reminder is that all this, these thoughts and all this, the stuff that, you know, the bushels full of stuff that we think we need to get rid of and all of that, like, just, I get the reminder that none of it is even real. It doesn't have the, it has no power because of its unreality. And I can give it, I can seem to lend it power by believing that, oh, this is horrible, now I need to get rid of it. Or I need to somehow resolve it. But if I just simply remember that It's nothing. It's an absolute zilch of nothing. Then I can just, whew, it's like, I don't know, it's just gone.
Well, and as it says right in the beginning of the Course in Miracles, nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists.
Right, and that's exactly it. It's like it has
exactly
no
it.
Existence. We give it existence, not real existence, but we give it reality. It can never have actuality. And when I remember that, very simple truth works miracles for me. And I was reminded in reading the section, the new section we started today in the course, What is a Miracle? It reminded me of the experience that I was given, the personal experience I was given that really taught me what is a miracle. And it had to do with an experience I had that involved fish and fishermen not finding fish. And then when I looked in the water, it was just, they were stacked like sardines. And it just reminded me of that story in the Bible about, the fishermen not finding any fish. And then Jesus came along and suddenly there were fish. So I didn't remember that story. So I went home and I found the story. And when I read it, you know, what Jesus had said specifically was, look on the right side of the boat. And I interpreted that to mean, look through your right mind. In other words, the mind of abundance. You know, they were looking through the mind that believes in lack. And so that they couldn't see the fish. And he didn't create fish where there were no fish before. He simply opened their eyes through correcting their mind to the abundance of fish that is always there. The truth is, it's always right here, but because of our mind closed off to it, we can't see it. And so all the miracle ever does is open our mind, open our eyes through correcting the mind, looking through the right mind instead of the wrong mind. And that was like such a beautiful lesson for me. Because I always thought of miracles as something like extraordinary. And then I realized, wow, they really do nothing but open our eyes to the truth. That's always already right there.
Right. It's life that is extraordinary in each new present moment.
Yes. We just don't see it when we've got all these, you know, errors in our thinking.
Yes.
Those errors have no power unless we decide to believe in them.
Right. And when we're looking through a glass darkly, we don't see the light.
Right. Nope.
Yep.
So I just
there
wanted to throw that into the mix.
Comments, Susan?
I know you're right, and I'm crabby as heck about it.
How are you generating crabbiness based on that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess I'm having a day when I feel like being ornery and contrarian and fighting with everything.
Okay. Well, I hope you can find some people that want to fight back.
No problem there.
Out there all by yourself.
No, that's not hard to find people. It's not.
Especially for somebody as practiced as you as being contrarian, right?
Yeah.
But can you see, Susan, how it's like you are basically lending your power, your God-given power to create, to thoughts that are making you feel horrible.
Yep, I can see how I'm doing that. I just want to settle up a few scores and then I'll be in the clear.
Yeah, I'll put my sword down after three more villages have been massacred. That's okay.
Right. That's it.
But
if
you recognize that all that's going on there is a whole bunch of nothing, because I know you value time, and it's a complete waste of time to even... It's a complete waste of time to even think about things, because you're dealing with nothing in reality, in actuality, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you're trying to fix something that isn't even there. So it's a complete waste of time. That's the way I'm seeing it anyway. So if I can appeal to your...
efficiency. Level of efficiency.
Say, wow, why am I wasting any time on these thoughts? And lending them some credence. Because they don't have any power at all. Because they don't even exist in actuality. We just imagine all this stuff into our reality that has no reality. But I understand where you're at because I'm there a lot too. And then every so often, it's like I just get this reminder, like I got this morning, like, wait a minute.
That's good. It's good if you can stay there. Yeah. It's good if you can stay there. Yeah,
well,
I think
it's just staying there for a few moments. Right? Sometimes the need to remind yourself is multiple times every minute. I remember a story where people were talking about a lot of this, setting Rachma and Kubha as filters over intention and perception. And I think it was Rex who asked Dr. Rice, so how often, you know, do you have to reset the filters? And Michael said some, you know, astronomically high number, like, you know, 60 times a minute or something, 30 times a minute. And so
that's
just a matter of being willing to do it persistently and consistently whenever the need arises. Mm. And to dismantling the shoulds as they show up, because a should is a counterproductive use of my mind energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's at the end of the hour, and there was a painful situation with the refugee center this morning that triggered a lot of this, but it's all the same anyway. Whatever it is, it's still error in thought. Yeah.
So what you're saying is there was an interpretation that you generated in response
right.
to a situation at the refugee center that is connected to a lot of pain for you.
Yeah.
So that would be the more accurate way to describe that.
That's true.
So I thank you both for the call. I realize we're at the end of the hour. I will mute you, and blessings to both of you. Thank you for calling. And I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. TM. Appreciate you. Good conversation, as always.
Show.
Thanks. Welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Tuesday, December the 7th, 2021, And our calling number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. We'll give Michael just a moment to get dialed in, and I hope that Mark calls back in to continue our conversation from yesterday. If you weren't on the show, go back and listen to it. It was around the Beatitudes, but talking about, you know, how do we get in that space of just being. And Michael, I think I hear you on, but your number's not showing up on the switchboard.
You do. I'm here.
That is really strange.
Technology.
Well,
weird. Yeah. Strange. It is. But we're here. And welcome, everybody. It's a delight and honor that you are here and ready to have this conversation that takes us to the next level in understanding this whole process around first century Aramaic forgiveness and the associated technology. We were in the middle of a conversation yesterday with Mark. Jeannie, is Mark with us today?
He's not, but we do have a hand up already.
Well, let's say hello to the hand up.
Okay. We've already talked to Susan and Ellen, but Ann has her hand up. Area code 760. You're on the air.
Hey there.
Hey there, young lady. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. I put my hand up at the end of Dr. Tim's show to try to add to what Dr. Tim and Ellen were saying to Susan, that it would now be 3-1. You know, that we now have to switch over to the more positive thinking because we were all, I was just smiling because of all the stuff, you know, I've had those same thoughts and had to get out of them, just like Ellen was talking about, and I missed it, but it was a delight to hear my reminders and say, hey, I'm smiling now because I've been there, but now I can be a participant in, hey, I'll send you the positive energy like Dr. Tim and Ellen were doing, and so we're pulling for Susan to pull out of her funk.
Sweet. Well, we'd be here to hold the space and create resonance for the next step up in the process of standing in Rachma. You know, our conversation yesterday was focused around this idea from the ancient Aramaic of Rachma, and it's such a profound piece of the puzzle. It was actually a story that I came across, and you know, recognizing this state, and that it's something that creates this pristine condition for the mind to generate its perceptions, and recognizing that perception has a quality, Rachma gives it the highest quality possible. It's kind of like an antivirus program keeps your computer on track. It inoculates against error, so Rachma does to the human mind, and there's actually research that shows that throughout the general population, people tend to develop prejudices based on negative information and be attracted to that more than the positive, which was kind of, I thought, interesting in that Rachma is what keeps us on track there. So there's a cute story that I came across that I'd like to share, and it fits perfectly with your comments, Susan. So a man of 92 years, short, very well presented, takes great care of his appearance, is moving into an old people's home today. His wife of 70 years has recently passed, and he's obligated to leave his home. After waiting several hours in the retirement home lobby, he gently smiles as he's told that his room is ready. As he slowly walks to the elevator using his cane, the assistant describes his small room to him, including the curtain for the window. "I like it very much," he says, with the enthusiasm of an 8-year-old boy who's just been given a new puppy. "Mr. Todd, you haven't even seen the room yet. Hang on a moment. We're almost there." Mr. Todd replies, "That has nothing to do with it. Happiness is something I choose in advance. Whether or not I like the room does not depend on the furniture, the decor, but rather it depends on how I choose to see it."
Mm-hmm.
That's perfect.
It's already decided in my mind that I like my room. It's a decision I take every morning when I wake up. And this is basically, you know, I hear this man describing that his practice is to set Rachma on a regular basis. He says, I can choose. I can spend my day in bed enumerating all the difficulties that I have with the parts of my body that no longer work well, or I can get up and give thanks to heaven for those parts that are still in working order. Every day is a gift. And as long as I can open my eyes, I will focus on the new day and all the happy memories that I have built up over my life. Old age is like a bank account. You withdraw it in later life what you've deposited along the way. So the advice to you is deposit all the happiness you can bring to your bank account of memories. Rachma, you know, it's exactly what we've been talking about with the Beatitudes, and that idea of the first law was to maintain this condition of mind. It had nothing to do with loving neighbor. It was to recognize and start to make a practice of maintaining this condition in your mind so that you stayed connected to the presence of love. And then to have the first beatitude we spoke about yesterday, the Greeks speak of is blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And Aramaic says the creator implants in your mind neural structures which will guide you when they are active. If they are inactive, you who follow these instructions will come into conscious possession of and be able to use this latent guidance system designed to make available thoughts and actions that will increase your happiness and well-being. So the instruction set, the first one, which we covered yesterday with Mark, is you who have a home in the active forces from the Creator, yours is, and it was translated as a heavenly estate. The Greeks translated it the kingdom of heaven, but it really says yours is the community of love. And when we start looking at these Beatitudes, they're so profoundly powerful that, you know, oftentimes I've run into and heard, especially when we're working with children, people in the culture will say, well, you've got to let your children make their own decisions, their own choices, and, you know, you can't control. Well, you know, that's true, you can't control them, but you can help them to build brain cells and understand the principles by which their own body-mind units work. And when they do, they're going to be able to operate this body-mind unit as it was designed to be operated. And the people in the culture out there saying, oh, you've got to let them do their own thing, are there vying to control them and build into their minds what they want built into the kids' minds. So it's powerful to just know that there's a set of principles by which this mind operates well and always gives the most intelligent possible response when we keep moving, you know, and it's a process. You know, I think back in my life, and it's taken years to step one step at a time toward moving in this direction, and still slip sometimes. So I'm with you on that, young lady.
Yeah,
and Mark
is
with us.
Okay, go ahead. All right, because I want to hear yesterday, so I'd like to hear what's going on. Thank you. Blessings.
All right, young lady, thank you. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you both and all?
We're rocking. How about you, sir?
I am as well. Great to be back with you.
Oh, good. Yeah, glad to have you back. We just had a brief conversation about Rachma and maintaining that condition in the mind. And so we were right in the middle of a conversation about your son yesterday when the show closed off, came to an end. So I'd just turn the floor over to you and see what else you have to share with what you went through. You know, you had been at the point where you'd said you were quizzing your son on whether or not he might be in error about his conclusion that life would be easier if he weren't here. How did that complete with him, and how's he doing today?
So that conversation was, I mean, it was one of the real turning points, you know, for him, and I think just his recognition of what he wants. And just to refresh for anyone who wasn't here yesterday, he was 11 or 12 year old son was talking about taking his own life. And so wife brought it to my attention. He and I sat down. I said, "Hey, what's your thought on this?" And he reinforced it and said that he thought everything would be better. And when I dove deeper into it and said, "Well, what if you're wrong? You know, what if you have this opportunity to actually process through whatever's going on here and live fully here? And if you did, you know, go to wherever he thought he was going to go, that you'd have to the same work." And it just kind of, you know, had him pause for a moment to reflect that, wait, so it means I might have to do this anyway? Like, it may not go away? So he thought about it overnight, and I think it was the next day, it was Saturday, I believe, and he caught me coming around the corner. He's like, "Hey, Dad, can I talk to you?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "I just wanted you to know I decided to stay." And at the time, though I don't have the emotion at this moment, at the time, there was so much emotion for me and this acknowledgement that we have our sovereign right to choose. And he didn't have to, right? And I know situations like that can turn a lot of different directions. You know, he could have in another home been brought to a doctor or, you know, diagnosed with something or, you know, all kinds of things, you know, put in a hospital. But in the matter of, you know, a few short hours, you know, with love present and the willingness to be in the conversation, which honestly, Dr. Tim had taught me, like, hey, if someone's talking about suicidal thoughts, like, talk to them about it. Don't be afraid of
right.
it.
Embrace
and,
it. Yep.
And he made that conclusion on his own, like, okay, I'll stay. I'm here. And he's doing very well. He's a teenager. He's 16 now, and he's about to get his driver's license and, you know, going through all the things teenage boys go through. He's such a loving human being, you know, a gentle soul. So it's really nice to see you know, people make that choice. And I think that can be the case for a lot of people who are struggling, just to have a conversation, to open up. Like, why? When I had suicidal thoughts, I was afraid I was going to hurt people. And I thought it would be better if I wasn't here. But it didn't mean that I shouldn't be here, right? And it certainly wasn't the case I didn't want to be here. And so there's a real opening, you know, that can be had, you know, when we can maintain our presence of love without drawing all kinds of conclusions and projecting, you know, into the future and doing the things that can amplify that energy. In this case, you know, and it's just one case, but in this case, it dismantled it very quickly.
Powerful. Powerful. What a gift. Yeah, you know, suicidal ideation, one of the things that they've shown in some research is that people who have a traumatic experience, and, you know, they label it PTSD. I don't think the D is really belongs in post-traumatic stress. I think it's just post-traumatic stress. It's the system's natural way of handling and trying to protect itself. But 10 times as many successful suicides come out of people who've had that post-traumatic stress type of syndrome. And, you know, that might be something to, you know, quiz him on. Was there something, you're aware of something that he went through that was traumatic? He saw something or what have you, that maybe he still might need some support and processing. And of course, you ask the same question of yourself, because that's oftentimes a major factor in the suicidal ideation.
I'll do that.
Cool.
I certainly know that I had stress.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you tie it back to, and you know, words are such a key part of the whole process. If you look back at the power person dynamic from the codependence work, that oftentimes, you know, the way that regulatory speech works is we first hear speech, then we repeat the speech out loud, then we repeat the speech silently to ourselves, and if we repeat the speech silently to ourselves, we experience that the behaviors associated with that speech as reducing stress, then it goes into the regulatory speech system, which to a great degree determines behavior and, of course, language. And so oftentimes there's a power person dynamic involved, and the power person was somebody who had more power over your life than you did at some point. It's usually a child, though not necessarily. That person was not functioning as love. And when the object of that situation perceives the situation as survival, then it's like the gates are opened on their whole energy field, and literally like a sponge, they just suck in every energy from the environment. And if that's never opened and dealt with, and in the future, when stress is elevated to extreme levels, then that power person dynamic comes back into play, and there are really only three levels of behavior possible for an individual. And it doesn't matter whether it's 2 years later, 20 years later, or 80 years later. When there's no stress, the automatic decision system runs the game and we'll do whatever we did to get along with our power person. When stress starts to build, we'll do whatever we did to resist and survive with our power person. And when we become ultra-stressed, we'll do what our power person did to us that we hated the most. And so the child who hears certain speech and they're in that kind of stress situation, it can be a powerful governing force if it's never reckoned with, if it's never opened and forgiven.
That actually ties nicely also into the second beatitude.
Yes. Let's look at the second beatitude. So the first word of each of the beatitudes, tuve hun, and I'll repeat that. The Creator implanted in your mind neural structures which will guide you when they are active. If they are inactive, you who follow these instructions will come into conscious possession of and be able to use this latent guidance system designed to make available thoughts and actions that will increase your happiness and well-being. And it's you who, and I would, if I were translating it now, if we're doing that work, I would change the word love in this translation. So we've got you who love truth. We would change that now to honor truth, because our whole culture, you know, if you listen to Vladimir Lenin, he says, if you want to destroy a culture, just change the meaning of its words. And we've been given this definition of love that it's a verb, it's something to do, rather than who and what we are. And if we're functioning out of that definition, you know, one of the first things that happens as young people come into the world, you know, if you hold a newborn child and you tap into the essence of that newborn, then that essence, if you, you know, we've asked thousands of people all over the globe, everybody's answer is always some variation on the theme of love. And then I ask people, well, now, is that newborn loving you, or is that newborn love? And everybody says, well, it's obvious, the newborn is love. So then when we use love as a verb, we set the mind on a pathway that towards something it can never achieve. It's going to be frustrated and blocked in that possibility when we realize who we are. So I would change that word now from who love truth, who honor truth, and profess your errors in the errors of your society, that we need to look into the thought structures that are based in hostility and fear. So this is the second step in making ready a mind to be available for the full and complete expression of the being that we are as love. And what this beatitude finishes with, you know, behind each of the beatitudes, there's a promise. The first one was, yours will be, you will live in the kingdom of, or the state of love. And the second one is, you'll be freed of mental stress. And, you know, the condition of the culture, by and large, is blockage of truth. And blockage of truth looks like this. I have a 9-bit mind. You know, perception goes into this 9-bit space. And my mind generates, especially if there's hostility and fear, a perceptual construct based in hostility or fear. And every perceptual construct based in hostility or fear is a lie. But if we call our lie the truth, we filled that 9-bit space of perception with a lie, called it truth. Now there's no room for truth to get in. So it's not until we honor truth that I keep hearing a banging in the background, sweetie. Can you mute whatever that is that's doing that? So when we're in blockage of truth by calling our lies truth, then there's no room for truth to get into that little 9-bit space. So the willingness to honor truth always puts us into alignment with what's going on in the actuality. And when we're in alignment, my take is that when we're in alignment with truth, people oftentimes say, well, what is truth? My take is that truth is what is in the actuality. And if we don't have a different idea that blocks that out, it will come in and correct everything in us that's off base. So the result would be we'd be freed of mental stress, as Yeshua said 2,000 years ago in this beatitude. Your thoughts?
It's right on. And just for reference for people, you know, just to in case they don't have it on the top of their mind, the second beatitude in the English was, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. And you addressed the Aramaic extremely well. And one of the things that I mentioned yesterday is I've also gone back just to look to see, well, what did the Greeks say about it? And the Greeks use a word, I think it's pronounced pentheo, though I don't know Greek, so I may be mispronouncing it. And in looking at pentheo, it matches what you're saying. You know, pentheo, it talks of an outer expression of pain that can't be hidden. You know, so it's, you know, properly grieve over a death as an example. But one of my favorite parts of this is in researching it, someone said it's really about coming to divine closure. And in order for something to come to that divine closure, to have that, you know, really be fully healed, if you will, you know, there is this allowing that which was hidden, right? That which wasn't, you know, brought forth, as you mentioned, with the truth. When it is brought forth to the surface, then that pain has an opportunity, you know, to be expressed, and that a pain has an opportunity to truly heal and be resolved in the individual. And the powerful part of number two here is, just like one and two and three, you know, these are to be repeated, right? It comes in layers, as you've talked about before, that there's what's up is up, and allowing that to be there, allow what was hidden to be exposed and breathe into that, letting the hidden hurts and pains and the grief and the shame or whatever it is come forward in that space of love. And that promise of being comforted is so true. There's a peace that comes with this process consistently, every time.
There's an element missing from the Greek where they say, blessed are those mourning their wrongs. The element that's missing is that there's got to be the willingness to honor truth. We hear lots of people who mourn their wrongs so publicly on the news and in their speeches, and, you know, they're always whining about what's been done to them and how they're such victims and all of that. And the element that's missing from the Greek piece of the puzzle there is, I totally missed this, the focus is, in Aramaic, is that, you know, the focus is on truth. The ability to honor truth, to be the space where truth is allowed to show up in the mind. And when people live in blockage of truth, what happens when truth shows up is their stress skyrockets. And that stress attaches to one of two things. It either attaches to getting rid of the source of the information that's delivering truth. You know, the classic example of that is John the Baptist. You know, he brought information to the king and queen that they were not interested in hearing. Their stress went up, and literally she had his head removed. And I always like to kind of tongue-in-cheek say, if you're going to play John the Baptist for somebody, if you're going to bring truth where people are in blockage of truth, there are two skills that John hadn't developed that you really want to make sure you got, and that is you got to know when to duck and when to hold the mirror up so that people realize the stress they're experiencing is their own. And until one honors truth, they'll tend to attach their elevated stress to the outside world. The alternative to that is that we can, when we recognize truth is showing up, I've got a new level of stress coming up, I can attach that to self-correction rather than attack. I don't have to puke on somebody else. I don't have to criticize, condemn, blame somebody else. I can shift that into, here, my stress level's up. That's the truth. This is mine. I have work to do. And so I attach my stress to self-correction. And by honoring truth, when, you know, something painful or traumatic, something that appears to cause my pain or trauma shows up, then I can shift that out of cause and start to process my pain and trauma. You know, oftentimes people say, well, this event was so terrible, it caused me all this pain. And the truth is, nobody's ever been pained about anything that's ever happened in their lives, ever, ever, about anything. I mean, sure, shy of a punch in the nose, you know, okay, so there's some physiological pain. But otherwise, when people say, you hurt me, you upset me, you disturb me, that's all a pure fantasy and a lie of the mind. If somebody's in pain, they're never in pain about something, they're in pain because there's pain in them. And if they live this beatitude, then because that event happened, they'll have the opportunity to heal that pain, and they'll stand as a connected space of love, maintaining rachma, and clean up the pain part, perhaps right down to including their genetics.
Does that fit? Makes sense for you? Experience with it too. Yeah, it's a... And it ties really nicely with this, just to share a lived experience for me as I was navigating the mind energy, if you will, the carbon-based mind of all these distortions. What would occur for me is I would consistently go to the breath. I mean, there was definitely a retraining that needed to happen for me to go to the breath and allow those active forces of God to really come into my life, right? That beatitude one. And then what my experience had been is if I had a, what I call a charge, where there's a charge of frequency that's from hostility and fear, et cetera, if there's a charge there, then that's contributing to blocking this truth. And so the willingness in that clear space that opens up from Beatitude One, it's that willingness to say, okay, I'm okay allowing this to occur. I'm okay allowing. And I actually, not sure if I'm the only one who's done this. I doubt it. But I'm kidding because I know it's not true. But I had blocked certain emotions. I was under the misperception that certain emotions were not acceptable to feel. Anger was one, which is a big deal. You know, if I'm thinking that I can't feel, then what happens is that charge would build, and then kind of overflow when it got too much for me to carry, or it was just too much. So part of the healing process for me was to allow, to actually go through a feeling wheel, which I can get on Google, and look at each of the emotions like, hey, what does this feel like? You know, what does surprise feel like? What is anger? What is fear? What do all these feelings feel like? And one of the things that I noticed as I first did that exercise is I couldn't distinguish certain feelings. Like, oh, I couldn't feel certain things.
Right.
So then I went through an exercise of saying, I allow myself to feel anger. And then the anger would come up, right? And I just gently start to see, okay, what is this? And I breathe through it. I'm like, okay, well, that's anger. Well, how is that different than fear then? Because I lumped some stuff together. And so just to reorient was a really critical part. Not that that's necessarily what Beatitude 2 is exactly saying, but in order to free ourselves of the lies and allow truth to really surface, this charge that's blocking the way needed to come up. So mine in this example was a hidden anger, you know, that I denied. And once I started to move into acceptance, it was probably a 6 to 8 month process because it kept evolving. It kept evolving. You know, it's like it felt one way in the beginning, and then there would be moments where it started to, I would say, mature. And instead of feeling it at a really high level or too low of a level, it eventually got to a place where I recognized it when it was coming up, and I could acknowledge that, okay, this is anger. You know, what's happening? You know, is there an expectation that's being missed, or what is it? And allow that truth to come out by accepting that the emotion was okay.
Right. If you look at that beatitude, actually, you just described precisely what the beatitude says. Profess your errors and the errors of your society. What are the thought disorders? And oftentimes what I hear you saying is, you know, with the anger as an example, not allowed, that's oftentimes a power person message. And power person's
yes.
allowed it, but you're not. And that's a really fertile ground for worksheets to clear that out of that power person, the false self that's based in the power person. You know, that when we talked yesterday about Yeshua saying, in order for you to live, you've got to die. The self that's got to die is the false image in the mind based in the power person dynamic. And it's the source of pained perception and stress that carries pain. And when we start to be willing to look at those errors, hold to honoring truth, hold the space for all of that to come up, that's when resolution occurs, and bingo, you're free to mental stress. It's just gone. It's like, here's how it works, folks. He wrote it down 2,000 years ago. Well, he didn't write it down, but you know, that's what he was giving us 2,000 years ago. The brilliance of the understanding is just...
And it opens the door to new perception. You know, I mean, it just
yes.
opens the door to, it's like, oh, I 10 minutes ago might have thought one thing, but once this is cleared out, it's like, okay, now we move to Beatitude 3, where we let go of attachment to things being the way that we thought they should, or that, you know, whatever that piece is. But to let go and to say, okay, I'm allowing new information, and I'm going to allow this to be different than the way I perceived it. And it's been remarkable to see how quickly, and part of it's acceptance, because one of the things that I learned was there's a right answer, right? I was trained in school. I went to traditional private school and just, okay, we get an A or a B or a C or whatever. So one of the things that I discovered in this, it's like, it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to not have the quote-unquote right answer. And the more I released what it is I thought I knew, the more I was, I would say, the more I was open to seeing with new eyes and experiencing that particular moment. And then the next step was realizing that it's okay for that one to change. You know, there was a little time where I felt like, wait, well, now I have the new awareness, so now I'm right. It's like, no, not necessarily, because there could be another wave, another layer.
Right?
It's fully recognizing just all we have is right now, you know, this moment. And so you mentioned the story yesterday about teaching for 27 hours without a thought, and that's it. Like, if you can stay in that present moment, then you're not trying to bring forward something from some past where you had kind of gotten it. You can allow for the fresh perspective, you know, that fresh insight
right.
to flow to whoever it is that you're speaking with in that moment for that group at that time.
And the answer might be different tomorrow. And what you just described, Mark, is exactly why in the worksheet, you know, the core of each worksheet is where you identify and cancel a goal. But then if you remember over on the right-hand side in the margin, I cancel my need to be right. I cancel my need to make up another reality based on this errored perception. And
right,
you know, each worksheet, that's like an integral part of it. And to me, that's part of allowing, is part of honoring truth and allowing literally the energy of the actuality to flood in and shift everything in me. You know, when we recognize that perception is nothing but a construct of the mind, and if something is in the mind and then turned into perception, obviously, whatever it is, it's from the past. And so when we live in what the world would call normal perception, we're literally engaging in the past again and again and again. You know, the essence of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And Yeshua said, of those who are doing that, you know, let the dead bury the dead, let the blind lead the blind. It's like, you know, you don't want to live there. And this part of honoring truth and then being able to look into our areas of thought, the areas of our society, clearing out these stressors that are held from the past, is there's correction in carbon-based memory. And from that point forward, everything that comes forward from carbon-based memory to formulate our perception is at least accurate about the actuality, but it's still not the actuality. And the next level is where perception comes directly from being rather than from carbon-based memory. And all kinds of new information becomes available as we allow that to open, and it becomes enlightened perception coming from, you know, to give a mechanical metaphor, coming from above rather than below, rather from the past. It comes from the actual present. And it's, you know, beyond any kind of comprehension or explanation. It's just something you got to do for yourself and experience.
Yeah, and it's easy to experience by just doing the work.
It's what it takes.
Whatever's in front of you.
Yep.
And I love, in the beginning, when I remember first, you know, meeting you and in 2012 coming to the Why Again workshop, there was, you may recall this, there was just this desire, like, what should go faster, you know, and over time, I've really matured into the appreciation of the particular insight and opportunity that's here. But in the beginning, I was chasing because I wanted so desperately to be healthy. And I would...
Everybody wants to storm the gates.
Yeah.
But you can't storm the gates. You just
got
to go through your process. Yeah.
Well,
I want this yesterday.
Right. And it's like you can't plant a seed in the ground and expect to pull the apple off the tree in a week. You know, it takes time. There's things that have to happen. And there's a process of transforming us, you know, through those active, the active presence of God kind of transforming our nature into that nature. And that is going to take time. It's not like it suddenly got skewed overnight. We're talking about generations of
massiveness
that we have embodied through, you know, the current generations, you know, and if the previous generations didn't clean it up, then we can either hide from it as long as we want to hide from it, or we can say, you know what, I'll do this, you know, I'll clean up, you know, what's going on in me and for my generations. And
right,
when someone makes that choice, it's a foregone conclusion. Because the willingness is there. So all the resources are going to show up. You know, they're going to show up in the form that's best for that person to receive these insights. And there's such a gift.
As are all the things that they're going to have to face and deal with going to start showing up. That's the other
side.
Where a lot of people shy away. It's like, well, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this. I don't want to deal with this. But when you realize that the major attribute of this body-mind unit, the Adam, Adamos, the red clay, is this multi-generational database that is so huge. I mean, its major attribute is inertia. It's moving in a particular direction at a particular rate of speed, and it's going to take some pretty strong forces to change its direction, and that's the process of healing, to literally, you know, when you look at that word repent, you know, the Greeks have abused that word so terribly, you know, repent, you sinner, as opposed to, it simply means to turn your thinking, your mind in another direction. So rather than looking to this multi-generational database and its appearances, its perceptual constructs in the past, that we literally turn and embrace what comes from directly from the mind of love, directly from the mind of the Creator. And that's our birthright, to have our perceptions come from there. And, you know, again, each of these Beatitudes is the instruction set for how to clean up the multi-generational database. What's required? What are the principles behind it?
And it's so interesting, you know, to be having this conversation, because we're in a time when so much out in the world is being, you know, brought forward. You know, essentially the things that have been hidden, you know, are being exposed. And one of the opportunities that our society has is to accept and embrace, like, oh, this is great. Like, another hidden, like, crappy thing that got twisted gets to be exposed. Like, let's celebrate and let's do our work on it. And we can do it individually. We can do it, I think, as a group. What I've seen is it can be even more magnified, you know, when we're dealing with these, you know, larger outer things. But when I first began exploring kind of the inner journey, and I think this might be a common thing, my whole focus was, oh, we've got to fix it out there, right? We've got to fix this problem in the world. Over time, and this was prior to even my 2011 manic episode, but that helped me see, like, oh, wait, I can't do anything of value out there until I actually have what's going on in here cleared up. So
exactly.
It became obvious to me that, like, the only work to do is to be on in terms of our optimal state. And if we're not in our optimal state, we're off, then we have these tools to apply and get into that on state. And what happens later in the Beatitudes is we begin to be moved out into the world. You know, begin to overflow with that love, and we begin to be reframed in terms of where we place our attention, like what we do in the world. It becomes this, I would call it the divine plan, you know, and we start contributing in our way to what we're called to do there, but it's in a real pure space. And even then, there's no finish. You know, because even as we're inspired with our divine plan, yours being, you know, to bring this work to every heart, mind, and being on the planet, then you're going to have to face the things that might be in the way of that plan being fulfilled. So you're going to have to go through a process of really cleaning up every last vestige of fear. And then
absolutely.
Even if you do a great job at that, guess what? Not everyone's going to like what you're doing. And so they're going to come possibly and most likely, according to the Beatitudes, they're going to, you know, start to project upon a person who's carrying that out because it's conflicting with the way that they have wanted it. And that could be in a home, right, with a spouse when you're changing. It could
For
be
sure.
a family member. It could be out in the world with your company or your job. It could be on a massive scale. You know, with you know, large implications. So if we can do this work and support people finding this work, we have an opportunity to then have those people inspired in their line of work, and suddenly you have people all over the planet who are these beings of light, of love in their jobs, in their roles, in their communiques. And there's an opportunity for massive transformation, but it doesn't happen by going out and saying, "Hey, let's massively, you know, change everything today." It's no, let's support people in doing the work as you've done over the last, you know, so many decades, to have, you know, people like me and others who have said, "Hey, I'm willing. I'm willing to do this. You know, this is what it is, and people on this call as well, this is what it is that is the primary purpose of my life. And anything after that is going to come out of that. That
definitely
shifts
key.
Careers. That shifts lives.
Everything, yep. For sure. Well, and this that takes us into the next beatitude, where the promised result, in Aramaic the word is nartun, is gain the earth. This is where you bring it into manifestation in the world. So the next beatitude says, you who have humility. Now, of course, the Greeks mistranslate that word, as with most of every other important word. And so humility has been used as, you know, groveling the earth like a worm. But in Aramaic, the definition of humility, and this is what this beatitude says, is to have that, is it's a mental quality of perceiving and cooperating with the good desires of others. And that when you do that, you shall gain the earth, the result. Now, the Greeks talk about it, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, like it's some sort of a passive, well, it's just going to come and fall on you, you're going to inherit it. No, this is a very active, by taking it into your work and your world, there's something that you earn. They will literally earn this reward, gain the earth.
Yeah, and I love, in addition, JM has a way of saying it that I really like as well, this, mm-hmm. this idea of inheriting the earth. And he says, a new ripeness shall bring renewed inspiration and confident strength will flow through them. And there is a restoration that I found in these practices that does bring, you know, that idea of earth is, you know, the represented as the physical, right? Who we are in the physical, like the heaven and the earth, the consciousness and the physical kind of coming together. And it's almost, I'd say what happened for me is I used to be, you know, prior to doing these tools over the years, I used to be kind of like a duck. And someone described me that way when I was in business. So like, you're like a duck. You look really calm on the surface, but you're paddling like crazy, you know, with all your insecurities underneath. And it's true. I was so insecure. I didn't have a strong bone in my body in terms of what I really thought. So I was very malleable, and I would try to get, you know, people to like me. And that was a big deal for me. Spent a lot of time. I went into sales, and it's a common thing for people in sales too. It's like I made that a priority. And when people liked me, I got, you know, so that process of unwinding that and getting to a place where no longer was I kind of this foreigner in my body feeling anxious and uncomfortable. But suddenly I, quote unquote, inherited the earth. There was this new ripeness. There was this settling in, right? There was this groundedness. And from that, confidence started to flow over time, and I became more aware of what my secondary purpose was. And that's key, because I remember the first time I did the secondary purpose exercise with you in 2012 down in Florida.
Right.
I still remember eating that juicy grapefruit off the tree. Desire to get it right. Like, oh, I got to do the secondary purpose, you know, because the primary purpose everybody's got. So the secondary purpose, so what's mine? And I wanted to get it really perfect. But I was coming from the carbon-based mind. I was coming from this place of like, well, what's right? You know, what do I quote unquote need and all that stuff. And over time, just doing these, my secondary purpose really shifted quite a bit. You know, I moved out of technology and moved into, you know, caring more about supporting people and finding these tools and developing themselves into, you know, the best life force that could come in their world, considering their family and friends and whatever it is that they touch, and became more of a priority for me. Like, well, that, there's nothing more interesting to me than seeing a human being fully live. So
for sure,
trust,
if
you've done the purpose exercise, trust, it might change as you do these beatitudes, or might not change necessarily dramatically, but it could alter, even if it's just the intention from which it comes.
Yeah, my experience over the years is I suggest that people carry the net result. And if anybody hasn't done the purpose workshop, the worksheet's pretty self-explanatory. If you just go to whyagain.org or through the app, you go to the page with links to the website, and you'll find the worksheet. Again, it's pretty self-explanatory, and the net result of that, I suggest that people carry that on a 3x5 card in their purse, their wallet, whatever, and every time they're going to do something important, they check it out. Is it in alignment with this primary and secondary purposes that I've established? And as we clean out carbon-based memory, if it's garbage, it's going to shift, like mega shift, in terms of what we perceive as our purpose. That's going to be, we're going to move out of the world game and into the game of what human life was really designed for. And for most people, that's a pretty major shift that happens.
And one of the things that we've experienced with Journey's Dream is we kind of have our vision of what the world looks like when there's no more mental illness. So in the beginning, we did these vision exercises, and we thought, oh, wow, we want, you know, this practitioner database where people come and find, you know, practitioners who believe in your full restoration to health. Like, that would be really cool. And we want this, you know, app to do this, you know, study of a scale of where someone is for that day and track it over time so people can have self-realization and stuff. And we had all these visions of, you know, dozens of things. And we felt discouraged in the beginning that we weren't able to do it fast enough or complete enough. And one of the things that happened one day is there was this experience of something that we had envisioned coming to us from another organization. And we knew we wanted to collaborate with others. But when we saw that, it's like, wait a minute, we didn't even have to build it. Some, you know, there's so that essentially that divine force is moving through people who are willing, right, and ripe, you know, for their inner world to be purified and then carry something out into the outer world that's going to be really constructive. And we've seen that kind of thing happen at least 6-7 times already, and it'll probably grow magnificently over the years because now we're more aware of, wait, just because we have it in our vision doesn't mean ours to do. It could be that just a revelation of something that's being created. So this goes back to the Lord's Prayer where it's like, give us this day our daily bread. You know, to give me today what it is that I need most. And to surrender into that and trust, you know, the mind goal management system that we will receive in that, the, you know, pure space, the insights that we most need for today, and we don't need to worry about tomorrow. You know, we can create plans and things, but tomorrow will take care of tomorrow. Today, focus on what it is that's optimal right now. So that coming together is really interesting to me. It's magnificent to see.
Yeah, you trigger in me, you know, you recognize that there are several inventions, if you check patent offices, that appeared in several places around the globe, things being patented literally on the same day in different countries, just, you know, like light years apart from each other, no communication, but the same patent was given in three different countries the same day when you realize there's definitely a different energy going on there. And the year you were at Heartland, do you remember, did we play the movie Brother Sun, Sister Moon?
I don't remember the movie, no.
Okay. Well,
you might have played it, but I don't remember it.
Well, as you're speaking, you might want to look this up and just spend some time listening to this piece of music. It's from the movie Brother Sun, Sister Moon, which is the story of St. Francis of Assisi. But if you look on YouTube, it's and Jeannie, I'll send you the link. You might want to just put it in the notes. But it's, if you look on YouTube and search for If You Want Your Dream to Be, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, and it's just a powerful piece. And basically what it says is, take your time, go slowly. Small beginnings, greater ends. That's powerful.
I wrote it down. I'll look that up after the show.
Yeah, cool. And I'm sending the link to Jeannie, so she'll have it. So let's take a look at our next beatitude. Let's see, we're down to about 6 minutes. We can probably cover one more. And this one, the Greeks say, says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and they shall be filled. And it's interesting to hear people, especially in the theological realm, talking about their righteous anger as though there was such a thing. I love what Einstein says about anger. It's found only in the bosom of fools. And yet many people think it's their, you know, it's like their mainstay. It's what motivates them. It's what works for them. And they don't realize the compromise of intelligence. It's there with that righteous anger. But in Aramaic, that beatitude says, you who hunger for, and the word in Aramaic is kenuta, and it's a mind structure, literally a tuv. Remember the tuvahun, the beatitudes, the creator plants in your mind neural structures. This is just a tuv. So what it's saying is the mind structure underlying the attitude, judgment, and behavior described by just and fair behavior between people. And you look at carbon-based memory, and so much is based on greed and fear and getting and possession and all of that. And this one says that ultimately what each of us needs to work with this carbon-based memory system is to cultivate literally a mind structure that the first order of business is always just and fair rather than the non-being mind's games of greed and fear and pain and trauma. And what the result is, and the Greeks say, if you've got that righteousness, you shall be filled. In Aramaic, what it says if that is if that neural structure, if you're hungering for that neural structure and you get that activated, then it will become your, again, it will become your possession. You'll attain it. How's that one impacted you, Mark?
So it's right on. And for me, one of the things that I experienced with this is, when I saw the fruits of using the practice 1, 2, and 3, and saw it again and again and again, that hunger began to develop, right? That change in me shifted from, okay, this is something nice to do when I'm in pain, to, no, this is something that is a way of life. You know, in the Hebrew, I wouldn't be able to pronounce the name correctly. I think it's Sadia, is one who follows the correct path, you know, the path of God or et cetera, which might sound a little close to righteousness rather than the Aramaic. But one of the things that I found is that there is this desire that births forth for what it is that's occurring. And for me, I had this insight that came periodically that would kind of almost give me a glimpse of the next state, right? This next state of, and I failed a lot. You know, I would get an insight to do something in the world that would have been really effective for me. And I got the insight, but I had fear and wouldn't necessarily always follow it. And then I would see that, oh, that would have been a good insight to follow. And so that created even more hunger.
We've got 1 minute.
Go back and do more of the Beatitudes. Yes, I'll wrap up. Maybe more of the Beatitudes and keep going to refine. But there's an inner and an outer. There's two things. One is to see it in others, as you mentioned. And the other is to really hunger for it in us. Because for me, when I went to me first and clarified that, then it made it easier for me to see it in others.
Right. And these mind structures, as you're developing them, it's good to recognize that they can be quite fragile. You know, if you remember the first time you went into French class or German class or Spanish class, whatever it was in school, and they spoke in that language, you went, what do you even, I mean, that means nothing. And then, well, you know, after three weeks in class, it was a certain, oh, yeah, I can say oui, merci, but it's fragile, collapses easily, and ongoing connected work is what makes those mind structures strong. And we are down to last second, so it's going to cut us off and just thank you. And Mark, if it works tomorrow, maybe we can continue the conversation.